This is Susan Robb for Teachers for New Era. I'm talking with Barry Mosier, whose artwork is represented in numerous collections, museums, libraries in the U.S. and abroad, including the National Gallery of Art, the Metropolitan Museum, the Library of Congress, the British Museum, the London College of Printing, the Vatican Library, and the Israel Museum, among others, and also at universities like Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Cambridge, and Dartmouth College. Mr. Mosier is a member of the Society of Printers in Boston and a founding trustee of the Eric Carle Museum of Picture Book Art. He was awarded a Doctor of Fine Arts from Westfield State College and from Massachusetts College of Art in Boston, and a Doctor of Humanities from Anna Marie College in Paxton, Mass. He's also a printmaker, painter, printer, designer, author, essayist, and teacher. He's illustrated and or designed more than 300 titles, including Moby Dick, The Divine Comedy of Dante, and his edition of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland won the National Book Award for Design and Illustration. He also did what's considered monumental work on the Pennyroyal Caxton Bible, the only fully illustrated Bible of the 20th century that the New York Times said might just be the Bible for our time. The book has been a subject of scores of stories in print on radio and TV, and also the subject of a documentary film, and was featured in the only one-man exhibit ever at the Library of the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. Nicholas Basbains, a prominent children's reviewer, has said, "Barry Mosier is probably the most important book illustrator working in America today." So thank you, Barry, for coming and making time. I don't know how you have time for much of anything, doing all of these things.
It's my pleasure, Susie.
Some of the books that I didn't mention out of the 300 were your children's books, Scary Stories, Cowboy Stories, Jack London's Dog, Telling Time with Big Mama, and also Aesop Fable Tales called Earthquack, which is a Chicken Little story, and Three Silly Billies. I also was interested to see in the mix of books that you had, things like Pilgrim's Progress, a picture book of Moses, and something called In the Beginning, a Creator's Story. So with all of that, the first thing I wanted to ask you about is that in all of that, you said you don't call yourself an artist. Why not?
It's too big a term. When I think of artist, the people that come to mind are people like Katie Kolowitz, Rembrandt, Velasquez, and so forth. And to put myself in that category and in that company requires a little bit more chutzpah than I actually have. And I tell this to my students too. If you give up the idea of being the artist and concentrate rather on your work, it's an extremely liberating and emancipating moment for you. Because if it is art, you're probably not going to know it in your lifetime. And if it isn't, so what? I mean, if you're always trying to do the next thing better than the last thing that you did, always trying to achieve perfection, which is unachievable, but always trying nevertheless, that's what's important. That's what I do, and I just don't like referring to myself as an artist, because sometimes I don't think I really know what that means.
So what did you think you wanted to do when you grew up?
I wanted to be a fighter pilot. But the only thing I ever did in school was draw. And when it came time to choose the ball team, I was always the last to be picked. But when it came time to do the Thanksgiving mural, I was always the first to be picked. So that stayed with me. That was the constant in my life. I'm still fascinated with aviation, but I am such a pacifist at this point that being a fighter pilot is like the furthest thing from my mind, though I'm still interested in it. But the main thing that stayed with me, even with a couple of years as a licensed Methodist preacher, the one constant, where everything else was shifting and changing, the one constant was my drawing. And so I took a degree, an undergraduate degree in painting. Actually, I was trained as an abstract painter. And it was probably the best education I could have as an illustrator and as a painter.
Now, you've worked in many, many different media, pen and ink and watercolor and all kinds of things. What are some of the favorite media that you work in?
Well, actually, I only work in two. Well, three if you count the drawing. Then that can be pen and ink, or it can be pencil or whatever. But wood engraving and watercolor are the two media that I use primarily. I guess the people ask me this all the time: why those two particular media? And the answer, well, it might sound a little bit, I don't know, funny, is that they're two extraordinarily difficult media. Wood engraving is the third most difficult medium that exists, the first one being fresco, and the second one being mezzotint, and then wood engraving. You simply can't make a mistake. Or you can make a mistake as long as you have the virtuosity to cover up that mistake and make it look like it was supposed to be there in the first place. But if you make a big blunder, there's only one thing you can do, and that's scrap the work and start all over again. Watercolor is less difficult than wood engraving, but nevertheless, it doesn't allow you an awful lot of room, and you also have to work very quickly because the medium dries quickly, so you don't have a lot of time to rework things, which when in watercolor is done well, it isn't reworked, and it has that look that watercolors have, which is very fresh and bright and not at all muddied. So those are the two media that I work in, and they're very immediate and they're very demanding, and that's the reason I use them.
I have a question from something you said. What's mezzotint?
Oh, mezzotint is a printmaking technique wherein a copper plate is rocked up with a brass rocker. And it looks kind of like the bottom of a rocking chair, and it's got a lot of teeth on it, but it's only about a 16th of an inch wide. So, and it'll rock up one line of teeth in that metal, a little roughness, and they come 320 lines per inch or whatever, they go up from that too and down. So if you take a mezzotint plate that's about the size of a telephone book, let's say, it could take the mezzotint printmaker as much as 2 months of long days just to get the plate rocked up. Now when it gets rocked up, it feels like a piece of sandpaper. And the idea is if you put black ink in that, or any other color for that matter, but if you put black ink on that and try to wipe it off, it won't come off. It's still embedded in there. And if you print that in an intaglio printing press, it prints a black rectangle. So the printmaker goes back into that with a steel burnisher and burnishes the metal smooth, so that you can wipe the ink off of it. And it is the most, and the reason why it's so difficult is it takes so long to rock that plate up, and to rock it up so that it is a perfect black everywhere. It's unspeakably difficult. But the actual burnishing, the actual making of the image is not that difficult. I've never made one myself. But I have done aquatints, which is making a plate very rough, but using resin, which is acid resistant, and acid, and the acid eats down and causes the plate to be rough, and then you can burnish that back. And that's fairly easy to do.
And what about your students? Because you teach at Rhode Island School of Design and Smith College, is that correct?
Well, I teach at Smith College now. I haven't taught at RISD since 2001 or so. I think 2000 might have been my last year there. But yeah, I teach at Smith College, and I teach printing. I teach my young women to run printing presses and how to set type and design a page and all that. We do have one unit, which is only about 2 weeks, but we have one unit on illustration. But a lot of my students are government majors. They're English majors, Italian majors. I've got one classicist this term. And they're not art majors. So it's not really, it's not something that I can, that I'm comfortable telling them to make an illustration. So what I will do, will show them how to steal their illustrations, which is what most illustrators do anyway, and also how I will allow a couple of people, if they're really uptight about doing it, I will allow them to write a paper describing what they're seeing and why, mm-hmm. Rather than actually making the image. But I've got several art majors too who will be making woodcuts and drawings and whatnot, whatever.
Now, do you deal with digital art in what you do? Part of the reason I wanted to ask you that is because, you know, now so much is happening in the area of digital art and self-publishing that I think it kind of gets at what we were talking a little bit about, of the idea that people have come to think of themselves as an author or as an illustrator, that doing that is a process rather than an art form. So I was interested in whether that's an area that you get involved with in digital or what you think about that area.
Yeah. For a long time, I wouldn't have a computer in my house. And for a long time, I could spot any book that the type had been set digitally. That was 20-something years ago. I can no longer tell books that way because the form of digital typesetting has come so far that now I favor it over the others because there's more that I can do with it as a designer. I can set 13.5 point type, for instance, which you can't do in metal. So I am now a devotee of digital typesetting, and that's when we did the Bible. That's 1,250 pages of digital type, which we had made into relief plates so that we printed the Bible letterpress, which means that the letters are actually punched into the paper. As far as the other digital world, I couldn't do without Photoshop anymore. Once I learned that program, because ever since my first book, I have built collages from photographs and drawing and whatever, all this stuff just mixed in together to build my images. And I can do the same thing in Photoshop in half the time and with a great deal more facility. I mean, I have a Xerox machine sitting on my counter that can go down to half, you know, 50%, or go up to twice, which is 200%, I would have to guess at what the right proportion was to get something in the, you know, like a head, putting a head on another figure or something like that. I'd have to guess and do it again and again and again. Photoshop, I can just, you know, move it a little bit, and it's wonderful. So I have actually come full circle from being almost a Luddite to being a devotee of the Mac, and I wouldn't have a computer in my house 20 years ago, I've got five now.
What do you think is important about the idea of participating in the whole process of book publishing? Because you do look at the whole book, I mean, including binding and things like that.
Well, I think, as I tell my students, the object that I make is the book. It's not the pictures that go in the book. Well, yeah, I make those too, but they're only part of the book. I personally think that the soul of a book is in its typography, because typography, when it is done well, disappears. Eric Gill said that typography is the art invisible. Because what happens is that if typography calls attention to itself, it interferes with the relationship between the reader and the author. And the point of good typography is to get out of the way and not have any interference between those two people. So that's when I start a book, I always design the type first. And make sure that how my pages are breaking and all that sort of thing, rather than starting with the pictures first. When I did the Bible, which has 261 illustrations in it, or 262, I think it is, at one point there were only 262 slots in 1,250 pages, and they were all blank. I had no idea what was going in. Well, I knew that there was going to be an image of Adam and Eve, and I knew that there was going to be an image of Ezekiel and so on and so forth. but I didn't know what they were going to look like. I just allowed myself a certain amount of space, and I used the space for the illustrations to manipulate my type so that every page has two full columns and every page ends on a corner. And so I used my images to push that type around, not the other way. So,
now, how much is that looked at today in the way that books are mass produced? How different do you think things are now?
Most books, mass produced or not, are generally not typographically sophisticated. And I don't say that to toot my own horn by any means, but a lot of bad design comes about from trying to save money. That's why you see in a paperback very, very miserly margins. And the reason for the miserly margins is because you get more type on a page if you have, little margin. But the thing is, it doesn't cost any more money to design something well than it does to design it poorly. So I'm not sure that there's, especially in the world of self-publishing. My Lord, people sit down at a computer and they've got 5,000 typefaces at their fingertips if they know how to get them. And there are too many choices. I mean, I really like to sit down and have a serious conversation with the people who decided what fonts should go in this standard equipment on a Mac. There's some really bad typefaces in there, and people who don't know the difference between a nice typeface and a bad typeface will use them willy-nilly. They also mix them up. I have a rule in my shop and in my studio: never more than two typefaces under any circumstances. And I have a running battle with a lot of my students who get into the ornament drawers, and they want to put ornaments in their pages, and they don't know how to use the ornaments. It's the most difficult thing in typography is using ornamentation. So I'm constantly preaching more is less, more is less, more is less, and trying to get them out of that. But That's what I'm thinking, is that the ease and availability of too much typographic tools, too many typographic tools, results in bad design.
What about books? Sorry. What about books in general? How do you see things in terms of the future of the book? If people talk about that, what do you think we can be doing to help keep kids engaged?
Well, I don't think there's a real contradiction between the cyber book and the real book. My wife is a bookseller and is a voracious reader. I mean, a reader who she probably reads 200 books a year. And she also reads books online. And so she's a devotee either way. It doesn't make a bit of difference. I don't like to read books online, though I do an extreme amount of reading on my screen. And when I'm designing books now, I design books on the screen. I'm not a fan of the e-book at all, but because I'm so much of a book man that I want that book in my hand. I just can't imagine going to the beach or lying up in a hotel room or something and with a computer in my lap. I mean, it's just not anything that I want to do. But I don't think that there's a threat to the book itself. It's just like I said, when the printing first happened in Europe in the 1450 or around then, everybody was talking about the demise of the real book, the manuscript book, the handwritten book. It didn't happen. The books kept on being written by hand. There's an enormous project going on right now in Minnesota at St. John's College of a handwritten Bible. They've been doing it now for the last 8 years, I think it is, or maybe even longer than that. Admittedly, there are not an awful lot of them being done anymore, but it's still being done 500 years later.
What kinds of things about a given story, when somebody comes to you with a story, a publisher, whatever, what is it about the story that piques your interest? Because you've done a mix of things, new things, classics.
Well, one of the first things is how much money they're paying me. I hate to be crass, but in Moby Dick, in the, I think it's the 33rd chapter on the whales anyway, the last line of the chapter is, "Oh, strength, cash, and patience." And I've never come across any sentence that better describes the life of somebody like me. You have to be able to put food on the table and a roof over your head and clothes on your body to be able to work. And so, and it's not, you know, it's my job. I don't do this as a hobby. And I need to be paid just like anybody else needs to be paid. And I, generally what I get paid is somewhere around the same level of pay as a plumber or an electrician gets. But I forgot your question. I got off on that. See, I told you that. What was the question?
I know what it was. It was how you pick what you want to illustrate, yeah. Right?
Well, first of all, somebody's going to have to pay me to do it. Second of all, I'm not real particular about the kinds of things I do so long as when I read it for the first time, I have vivid images in my head. If that doesn't happen, then I'm not interested in doing it. I don't want to have to, even though those vivid images that might come, you know, right out of the blue might not be anything like what it ends up, but I have to. It has to have something to it that's visual. And then I have certain strictures about what I will not do. And I will not do anything that is racist, that is fascistic. I won't do anything that's anti-feminine. I won't do anything that's gay bashing or any of that sort of thing. I am one of those loathed individuals who are liberals. So, and I wear that with pride. So that's, I mean, I do have a lot of different kinds of things coming to me, and I think it is because I'm not that particular about the genre of the literature.
How is it different, or is it, illustrating something that you know is going to be primarily for adults or primarily for children?
I don't think there is any difference. I think that when people start making illustrations, quote, for children, unquote, it's this sense that they're talking down to the children. And I won't do that. So as far as I'm concerned, making an image of Br'er Rabbit, let's say, and an image of Beatrice in The Divine Comedy, there's no difference. It's all a matter of manipulating the plastic elements. I mean, I have line shape, color, form, you know, all that sort of thing, and I have to use those, I have to orchestrate those individual instruments in the orchestra, if you will, to compose the symphony. Whether it's a symphony is for children or whether it's for adults doesn't make any difference. There might be a difference in tonality, and I don't mean graphic tonality, but literary tonality, in that most of the books that I do for children have an element of humor to them. And my books for adults tend to be very dark. And I don't know why that is. It's just the way my mind works. It's like Flannery O'Connor said that she had a feeling for the vulgar, meaning the commonplace. And I have a feeling for darkness and the vulgar. So.
What about black and white or color? When you imagine at the beginning of something, does an art director say to you, I'm envisioning this way, or is that entirely your choice?
It's usually my choice, but then again, I'm an old dog. I've been around for a while. But there is a prejudice in the children's book industry against black and white illustrations. Personally, I think it's unfounded, but apparently the industry has done research that show children do gravitate more towards the colorful books than they do towards the black and white books. I have done a number of black and white books for children, but then again, none of them are real big sellers, so I suppose that sort of proves the point, doesn't it?
So, but when you envision, coming into that, when you envision a story, what would make something more likely to be a black and white or a color?
Well, I think in black and white. So when I conceive a book and when I'm designing my images that are going to be painted, I design them in black and white. I don't know. I mean, I did a wonderful book with Virginia Hamilton after she was dead called Wee Winnie, Witches Skinny. and they're engravings. They're black and white, but I colored them. So there, it has both of those worlds there. And I can also do watercolors that are extremely dark and having very little color as such. I mean, there might be 10 or 12 ranges of colors, but they're all in the darker registers. So I don't see that there's one thing or the other, but more than likely when a job comes to me from a publisher, it's going to come along with the expectation that these images be watercolors or they be in color. Sometimes I will get into a debate or a conversation with an art director about whether it really should be that way or not, but and sometimes I've won the argument, and sometimes, most of the time, they win the argument because they're the ones with a pocketbook.
One last question. What kinds of things are out there that you would wish to be able to do art for, or are there media areas that you'd like to explore? What would you like to do in the future that you haven't done?
Well, I'm too old to start learning a new medium or being able to master a new medium, put it that way. In terms of books that I would like to do and projects that I would like to do, I would die to be able to illustrate the fiction of Flannery O'Connor. And in fact, I'm working now with the University of Georgia Press trying to facilitate that precise thing. I would like to do Canterbury Tales. I would like to do Don Quixote. So you see where I am, where I want to, because I came into the children's book world very much through the back door. By the time I did my first children's book, I had already designed and illustrated probably 100 books. And because I didn't do my first children's book until 1984, and I did my first book in 1969. So it was a long time before. In fact, I was prejudiced against doing children's books. I remember having a conversation with my partner, my business partner at the time, who, when I was offered my first children's book from Harcourt, and I remember saying to him, "I don't know if I want to do this or not, because when I do my Bible, 16 years before I did that Bible, I said, when I do my Bible, I don't want it to be said that it was done by a children's book illustrator." And then I did my first children's book, and that's when I realized what I was just talking a minute ago, that there really isn't any difference between making an image of Br'er Rabbit and Beatrice. I mean, it's all a matter of manipulating those materials, and that was a profound moment in my career, is to realize that there's no real difference. And is there something in the children's arena that I would really like to do? I've done 20 or better, yeah, about 20 of the Br'er Rabbit stories. But I would not turn down the opportunity to do an entire, you know, the whole thing. And I don't know if there's anything else. I didn't read books when I was a child, and I read some strange things to my children when they were growing up. I read them the Br'er Rabbit stories. I read them Edgar Allan Poe and so forth. So I'm not really well versed in the canon of children's books. I don't. There are probably hundreds of things out there that I would love to do, but not enough time.
Well, one thing though, too, is that with children's books, I mean, it is something that is so shared between adults and children, and so to be able to expose children to very, very beautiful artwork like yours is really a treat. Well, thank you, Barry, for doing this.
My pleasure. Thank you.